My name is Justin Gage, and you're tuned in to the Aquarium Drunkard Transmissions Podcast with your host, Jason Woodbury.
Welcome back to Aquarium Drunkard Transmissions. Though he is known for his fiery, raging performances with groups like Sons of Kemet, Chewbacca and the Ancestors, and The Comet is Coming, who have appeared here on Transmissions, Chewbacca Hutchings eases into a contemplative zone with his new album, Perceive Its Beauty, Acknowledge Its Grace. He joins me this week on Transmissions to discuss it. Released on Impulse Records and recorded at the legendary Van Gelder Studio in New Jersey, where John Coltrane cut A Love Supreme and many other jazz classics were minted to tape, the album finds Hutchings setting down his sax in favor of a variety of flutes and pondering questions about what it means to be, what it means to do, and how one gives themselves over to energizing forces. Joined by guests including Saul Williams, Euclid, Esperanza Spalding, fellow flute devotee Andre 3000, and previous Transmissions guest Floating Point, Laraji, and Carlos Nino, Hutchings drifts into a gentle, New Age-inspired zone, blending spiritual jazz expression with ambient sensibility. I really enjoyed speaking with Chewbacca, but before our chat, a quick word. Are you an Aquarium Drunkard subscriber yet? We are working directly with our readers and listeners and viewers over at Aquarium Drunkard, forming the Aquarium Drunkard membership. Head over to Aquarium Drunkard and subscribe so that you can help keep this project humming along, delivering you mixtapes, newsletters, interviews, radio shows, podcasts, videos, and much more. We've been at it for nearly 20 years, and with your support, we will continue on into the new decade. What does it mean to make music of spiritual substance? What does it mean to be spiritual? What is spirit? This week on Transmissions, Chewbacca Hutchings joins me to discuss those questions, his shift towards the flute, the lasting influence of Outkast, and connecting with his father, the dub artist, who joins him for an incredible performance on this record. I really enjoyed this conversation, and I hope you do too. Thanks for listening. I'll speak with you more on the other side. This is Transmissions. This new record is really, really tremendous, which is one of the reasons why I've been looking forward to discussing it so much with you. You know, when you were on Transmissions last, you were with the folks in The Comet is Coming, and you told me was a quote that you said you had grown up hearing, where you said something like, "The aim is to know more and more about less and less until you know everything about nothing." And in some ways, I feel like this new record is sort of maybe ties into that somehow. There's something going on where it's like the effortlessness and the openness of this record really does feel like it's you arriving at a new place. I don't know how it feels for you, but when I listen to it, it definitely feels like a debut record in some ways.
Yeah. I mean, I've spent a lot of time on it in that it's been about 2 years in the making. So, you know, it's really made me think about what it is to live with a body of work and like what processes go on in terms of actually refining what you think of it. So like, you know, what happens when you spend a lot of time on work isn't that you add more and more layers to it. What I find is that there's this like selection process where you actually become a bit more selective about what you think isn't appropriate or isn't necessary.
Sure.
And I just found myself going back and just like taking out or cutting back a lot more. And yeah, and then arriving at a point where the only things that's left are the things that I think are the most essential. Which reveals a part of, I think, my personality, in that it's really made me realize that I like minimalism in terms of artistic minimalism, in terms of just what I actually like, what feels like the most essential part of my, choices, my decisions.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, you mentioned that you worked on this record for 2 years. Is that longer than you would normally work on a record? What was it about this one that warranted you spending that time?
Well, I started the process while within the Sons of Kemet. Yeah, well, I guess while within the Sons of Kemet touring in 2022. And the aim was always to actually have a year where I just sit with the record. I just sit with, I don't release. That was always like the long-term plan. I recorded it in a year in 2022. In 2023, I just live with it. And then it comes out in the following year. It was, I'm a man of plans. So I always have these big overarching schemes that that fortunately mostly like come to pass. And one of them was that I wanted to release this album, my first under my own name, in the year of my 40th birthday.
Well, yeah.
And this is 2024.
Well, congratulations on turning 40. I also, that's what I'm doing the same this year. So I'm going to pretend that this is also a present for me on my 40th birthday.
Yeah.
Well, perceive its beauty, acknowledge its grace. I mean, it feels like, like I said, the last time you were here, it was to talk about The Comet Is Coming, which is a pretty furious and kind of like, it's an onslaught of sound. This album, much more contemplative and quiet. It's a very different zone. What do you attribute that shift to? Is that also something where you had felt yourself being called more and more towards maybe quieter spaces? Obviously, you're foregoing the saxophone on this record. People know you most as a saxophonist. Was it the flute itself that lent itself to the more subdued palette that you're working with on this record?
I think it is, in that, when you're really getting into the flute and what it is to play in nature and what it is to play outside, it's really a different dynamic and a different approach to how you place your sound within other sounds. And I guess it's all up to people's individual temperaments, but mine is that I want to hear blend. I want to see, I want to explore how sounds fit together. Even when we recorded it in the same room without any separation or headphones, it's meant that just organically the musicians had to listen in a really deep, sensitive way. But looking back, I've done a lot of thinking about this transformation into the quieter, dynamic, and it feels like it's always been there, in the peripheries of all the albums. There's been these moments of quietness or these moments of sensitivity, but they've always taken the back seat to, you know, the more bombastic elements. Yeah, but with my, you know, like something of my own, I just felt like, you know, this is what I'd like to portray as being, you know, the representative of where I'm at the moment.
Yeah.
Trying to explore that, you know, different emotional palette. And I think that actually, you know, as an artist, what we are multidimensional beings. You have like broad emotional, you know, landscapes. And sometimes it's easy to fixate on one aspect of that landscape, the parts that might be the more commercially successful or more satisfying to audiences in a particular environment, but actually a part of the, you know, the journey of understanding where, you know, like how we belong artistically or what our potential is to really just stretch, you know, ourselves and just try to, yeah, explore unexplored, you know, emotional terrain.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that comes through on this record, which just from, you know, the titles to the lyrical content, I mean, it really is you opening up and revealing what seems like a different side of yourself to us, the listener. But as you said, musicians are multidimensional. I don't know a single musician who thinks their music only makes sense in one context, right? Or only conveys one feeling. I think the beauty about music is that it can even convey more than one feeling at a time, you know, which I think this record does. But I'm curious about the shift away from the saxophone. I don't want to be too reductive, but I'm curious, you know, did you feel burned out on the saxophone? Is that the term you would use to describe your relationship with it? What was that shift like?
No, not at all. I actually feel really invigorated by the saxophone. And I feel like my saxophone playing has been getting better and better to the point where like the best, you know, the most satisfying saxophone experiences I've had have been going towards the end. And that's been the paradox of it, in that it's not that I'm tired of the sax, and it's not that my sax playing is waning. It's just that artistically there's something else that I need to dedicate my focus to. And it's got to be a unidirectional focus, at least for a particular period of time, in dedicating myself to the flute. And yeah, I really felt it, like, you know, from the point where I made the decision personally and then publicly that I was going to stop playing the sax, it put this focus on the instances when I was picking up the sax in terms of what do I want to express on this instrument, considering that each time I play it is going to be a reckoning. It's going to be the last time in any given city or with any particular combination of musicians. And yeah, I really love playing the saxophone, but, you know, it's not always about doing what you love. It's doing what needs to be done for the purpose of artistic growth.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's tough. And it took a lot of soul searching and the questioning of like why I'm doing what I'm doing. And what do I really want to come out of me? Yeah. And the result is me just saying, making a proclamation and saying, actually, the sax is over. I think that it doesn't represent where I want to go on a deep personal level. And you can articulate these things in words, but actually it's a feeling. And it's an intuitive understanding, you know?
Yeah, that notion of it being an intuitive understanding. I mean, I really do think that musically, songs tend to, I think, if you're a sensitive, tapped-in artist, like I know you are, I think songs tend to sort of tell you what they need or how they want to come out. Were you deep into the process of writing this material when you realized that the saxophone was not the tool that you needed to reach for? Or was that something where, you know, I always think about how Bruce Springsteen cut the Nebraska demos on his own and then got with the band to play the songs and realized, these aren't going to work with the band. The demo is the right thing. The demo is the actual finished project. So did you start in on these songs with the sax and then realize, it was more holistic than that.
Yeah. In that I went into the studio.
Yeah.
only with flutes.
Right.
Knowing that this, what I'm going to record, is only going to be with flutes. And I kind of, you know, if I'm really honest, I kind of knew that the sax was going to be coming to a close, but it wasn't as formed conceptually as it would be. But I just knew in any case that the album was a flute or a woodwind album.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
That split between woodwinds and reeds, you know, I mean, that is a really, I think about how I have very limited experience on flutes at all, but it is a completely different kind of physicality that produces the sound when you're using a flute, right? I mean,
yeah,
it's go ahead, please.
It's deep in that there's some similarities in terms of how you pressurize your body and in terms of how you need to allow resonance. And on a fundamental level, stuff is resonating.
Right.
The material that you're blowing has to resonate freely. Now, the issue with the reed is that the reed ligature setup is a technology to allow the reed to vibrate, and that vibration causes the resonance of the member of the saxophone or the clarinet or whatever.
Right.
If you don't have that technology of the reed, it means that you yourself have to be the thing that causes that vibration and resonance, meaning that you have to be resonant. You know, so it seems like what that means is that it's possible to be incredibly tense while playing the saxophone, but if you put enough power through your tension onto the reed's going to vibrate, and that vibration is going to cause the metal to resonate. Whereas a flute, because you don't have that technology, it means that if you're tense and you're applying this tension to your mouth and your mouth to the flute, you're gonna hear it in the sound. You're not gonna get a good flute sound, if anything.
Yeah.
So it forces you to actually consider tension and relaxation and how to generate an energy through relaxation more so than it does on the sax. And this was one of the issues that made my saxophone playing really improve the more I practiced the flute, because the questions that you have to deal with on the flute, you know, like I just said, to do with relaxation and to do with energy through relaxation, they really help your sax playing. You know, they really help that fundamental thing of how do you play the instrument.
Yeah, yeah. I think about how so much of the titles on the record, you know, there are a number of references to breath on the album, right? Breathing, I think managing my breath, comma, what fear had become. Even something like, you know, the song Body to Inhabit, I mean, I think of that also in relation to the instrument itself, right? Because the flute is a, like you said, you don't have that technology working for you, right? In terms of pure amplification even. So I don't know. I mean, the flute, it obviously has its connotations. People think of the flute in certain ways. And obviously that airy kind of, I hate to use the word mystical, right? But I mean, if you're watching a movie and they want to imply some mysticism, good chance a flute might pop in on the soundtrack. But but how did you end up being drawn to the flute? I know that at least, because you play a number of different flutes on it, and I know that there's the, I don't know if I'm going to be able to pronounce it right, the shakuhachi, I think?
Yeah.
Which is like a bamboo flute that you got in Japan. Was that one of the, was that sort of what kicked off the interest in woodwinds?
It wasn't my absolute first flute, in that the absolute first one was a flute I got in Swaziland a few years before. But that one wasn't anything that I'd really concentrated on, and it was more like just an ornament. Whereas the shakuhachi flute was the first one that I got and decided I'm going to actually try to learn this thing. I'm going to try to like see what it is.
Yeah,
I wasn't really that into shakuhachi music, and I only actually heard the shakuhachi being played live by someone, you know, and not on a record or on YouTube or something, a bit over a year ago while in Japan, because I really have gotten into the flutes in a practical way. I got into them because I've been playing them, and then through the playing them, I've gone on these routes of meeting other players and other makers and having this journey with them. But it's not that I was obsessed with the shakuhachi and the tradition around it. But through playing it and through going on this journey, then it's like I've come into contact with what the tradition is. But I guess because of my, you know, relationship with the jazz tradition, Miss Similarly is another tradition or musical form that I'm coming to as an outsider, as someone who isn't from, you know, the place of origin of that, you know, style. I just think it's about your relationship with the instrument as a core instrument and your ability to listen and reflect on how what others have done can influence, you know, what I want to do, like how I practice the elements of, you know, I might listen to a shakuhachi piece and then just think, what about this do I like, and how can I practice in a way that incorporates it in some way?
Yeah,
you know, opposed to saying I'm going to learn a repertoire. It's all very organic, my relationship with, you know, the progression of myself with the shakuhachi.
Yeah. Particularly that flute, if I understand right, is keyless, right? So, I mean, does that mean, I don't know if that means keyless as in terms of having the pads, or if it's related to the intonation, which is that?
Keyless in terms of not having pads?
Yeah, I guess nothing can be keyless in terms of the pitch, but everything has a key somehow.
Everything
has
a foundational pitch. But this is one of the issues I'm actually dealing with flutes. Normally, the bottom notes on the flute is what you associate as being the foundational pitch, or it might be in D, and the bottom note you play is D in like a D pentatonic scale.
Right.
But what I'm trying to do is actually practice each chromatic note on the flute. If I adjust my finger position to make half holes and then try to make the flute chromatic and then just play in different keys. I'm doing that less on the shakuhachi and more on the side blown bamboo flute, so like say the Brazilian pifano, and trying to literally just play, you know, I'll be playing like bar etudes very slowly. I'm just bar by bar, or doing like my jazz, you know, vocabulary, just playing phrases that I would normally play and doing them in all 12 keys. I'm just trying to get a facility on the flute, which means that I can think onto the instrument. And this is one of my big challenges in that. I don't think the sax in particular is the thing that people are attracted to, you know, in regards to me. I think it's my ease in expressing my ideas on that particular instrument.
I see what you mean, yeah.
Yeah, and they just don't have that proficiency with the flute. And the only way to get that proficiency is to firstly concentrate on it exclusively on that school of instrument, and then to just practice it like crazy, you know, I can actually, you know.
Was there a lot of practice leading up to this record then? I mean, there must have been, because you certainly sound fluid and completely in possession of the technical prowess on this record.
Well, yeah, I mean, it didn't feel like that when I was in the studio. I practice every day, and from the point where I realized this is something I want to do, this is kind of coming towards the end of 2020, I had this like realization that actually what I need to do is practice every day. There's no easy answer around it. It's just a question of just being familiar with the instrument intimately. Even just now, like I played a big ears festival a couple of nights ago in Knoxville, and I've come there from Barbados, where I spent 3 weeks just practicing as much as I could every day, in the house I grew up in, actually.
Wow.
And it's really done a lot for my just familiarity with the instrument and ability to just relax and play ideas, you know, with ease and fluidly, that I can then build on when I start actually kind of hitting the stage, as it were.
That's right. Go ahead. Yeah.
No, I was going to say, this, you know, the issue of like how I sound on the record is interesting, because, you know, going into a studio like something prestigious like Van Gelder Studio that's got so much history, I'm playing with musicians like, say, Jason Moran or Esperanza Spalding, who are real virtuosos at their instrument, and me feeling like, you know, I've got musicality and I've got, I guess, taste in that I understand what I want musically. but just not being as proficient as those musicians really made me have to dig deep in terms of thinking, how do I creatively use whatever skills I have at my disposal? And I think that's a good challenge for any artist, to not be out of their comfort zone and have to think, how do I summon creativity considering that I'm not doing what comes most easily to me?
Yeah, no, that's really, really fascinating to think about, because obviously, like you said, the Rudy Van Gelder studio, you know, nothing but classics, you know, come to mind when you think about that studio. Kind of Blue, Love Supreme, whatever. So for you to be in that space with these players and, you know, to put yourself in the position of vulnerability, essentially, you know, that's a really interesting approach. And I think that, I think it somehow, it must have informed what's happening on the record, you know, because I just think of it as so, as a very open record and as a very, deeply expressive record, you know, in a way that just is different than what I've heard from you before. So I think you made the right choice, however difficult it must have been, to say, all right, I'm going to get into this position where I kind of don't know exactly what I'm doing. You know what I mean?
And hopefully it's not the end. Like, all I can hope for is that there becomes another shift when the time is right.
Right.
Because I really am, I'm in constant fear of becoming, you know, I've said it in other interviews, but because I really believe it, I'm in fear of becoming an artist that gets older and just less interesting. You know, I really hate it when I love an artist and I love them in a period of their, you know, artistic career, and then you kind of listen to their work 20 years later and it's just boring.
Yeah.
But they sell out big concert halls.
Right.
And they, you know, and they respected because of what they did in the past. I just really think that you've got to just keep learning.
Yeah.
You know, and that learning only comes from needing to learn, you know?
Yeah, no, most certainly. Most certainly. I think about how some of my favorite artists, David Bowie or Lou Reed or Pharoah Saunders, for that matter, right? His last album doesn't sound like any other Pharoah Saunders album. You know, that's...
Yeah, exactly.
The record
was... Way shorter also.
Yeah, you know, totally, right? These people who aren't interested in preserving the legacy in this sort of, like, staid, respectable way, but nonetheless are, like, they have to push into different territory. And I feel like that's really cool. You know, listening to this record on Living, you know, your playing on that record is so sprightly and it's kind of like darting around. And I was like, what is this flute? That's a Sivirol? Is that how you say
Sivirol,
that?
Yeah, I guess Sivirol, yeah.
Yeah, so that's like a Slavic flute, something you might find in Russia or Belarus or Ukraine.
I actually got that in Russia. I did a gig in Russia with Sons of Kemet.
Oh, wow.
Malta. To if there are any traditional music shops that they could take us to, you know, the next morning. And he took me to the shop and I tried out a bunch of flutes. I actually bought a bunch of flutes to the rest of the bands and just gave them as gifts.
Oh, that's so cool.
And then found these flutes that they're really great. I also got these great overtone flutes that aren't actually on the record. They're on the record on Body to Inhabit. In the middle of Body to Inhabit, when the bass line changes, they these kind of high pitch, and things that's the overtone flute, basically. Called a Tilinko from Bulgaria, but also with a Russian equivalent.
Yeah, wow, that's so.
It's far back in the mix, so you wouldn't necessarily hear it. And this is another thing that I've gotten into in this record: the idea that everything doesn't need to be at the front. So there's things on the record that are pushed back so much that you can't really hear it. You can perceive it, but you can't hear it specifically. But it means that you've got a situation where there's some mysterious elements, and I really think that's important. That there's mystery in albums, that you hear it for the sixth time and you notice a detail that you didn't hear on the first. I'm not really into albums where you listen to it and you go, "I've heard all the music in the album." what's next?
Yeah. No, I know what you mean. I know what you mean. And I feel like there's such a easy temptation with the amount of music that we have available for us to listen to, you know? There's such an easy temptation to listen through something once and go, oh, I got it. I know what that is now. Yeah. Enjoyed that. Moving on, you know? Whereas like a classic record has hidden details and little things that you would not notice until you've given it proper time, right? And allowed it to unfold. So I'm glad that you're putting that kind of intention into it. I think it comes across, you know, I mean, I feel like when I was thinking about the sort of the first half of the record sort of has these heavier titles, I feel like, you know, The Wounded Need to Be Replenished, Insecurities, As the Planets and Stars Collapse. And then it feels like in the second, it starts to shift into a slightly more expansive space, right? Living, breathing, Kiss Me Before I Forget, I'll Do Whatever You Want, which is a really beautiful song. I love the work that Laraji does on that one. Laraji's been on this show, and I've had a chance to talk with him a few times. He always blows my mind. He's just such an interesting thinking guy. But he's almost doing like a Leon Thomas type thing on that one, which is so exciting.
I saw him this morning, actually. I saw him at the, because he was also in Big Ears, like I know him chatting to him this morning in the airport.
Wow, that's amazing. How long, when did you first run into him? And were you familiar with his music, you know, coming
not
up?
Not so much. I only became familiar. Carlos Nino actually invited me. I invited him.
Yeah,
And said, you know, Laraji's, you know, in town, you know, do you mind if I invite him to the studio? And I was like, yeah, sure. And then it's after that, I actually checked him out and realized, oh my God, I've got a legend in, you know, has been invited.
Yeah, yeah. That's so cool. I mean, and he is just like, he's fascinating, but you know, his thing, his whole, like his laughter meditation, you know, you tell somebody anything, you talk to anybody about like a meditation and it's going to seem like it's this really serious, you know, intense, focused thing, which of course it is. But then you realize that like, Laraji's out here practicing this sort of laughter meditation, this thing that isn't so self-serious, and you realize there's just so much room, you know what I mean? And I feel like that's sort of what I'm getting at with the second half of the record, is that it just feels like it gets more and more open and inviting as it goes on, which is really great.
Yeah. And this is something that I really worked on, and that I'm a really big fan of arcs, like the arc record, like how does it how does it move forward and how does it resolve itself?
Yeah.
So there was a real big, there's like a dark tension in the beginning, and I wanted it to be, it gets so tense that by the time the first beat comes in Body Turn Habit, it just feels like it's this weight that comes off of your shoulders.
Yeah.
And the beat's only a hand clap, a single hand clap that goes through the whole tune. But because this like dark tension that goes all the way to that point, it feels a lot more significant than it actually is.
Yeah.
And then at that point, you kind of float off. But in terms of the titles, it's really interesting in that I've got my personal meaning to like how the titles are formed. And it's to do with possession, you know, with like spirit possession, in that it kind of starts with a rift. It starts with, you know, the end of innocence, you know, the planets and the stars collapsing, like your world basically collapsing inwards.
Yeah.
You know, there's a fracture somewhere, you know, you're insecure. You don't know where you belong. You know, you don't know where you're going. Managing the breath, what fear has become, that fear of actually being lost and confused. And then the wounded needs to be replenished, talking about what needs to happen when you've had that like scar of being dislocated. Body Tearing Habit is talking about the possession that happens, you know, something takes over you, gives you a spirit that's outside of where you're at. I'll Do Whatever You Want is you surrendering to the spirit that's going to give you an energy outside of what you've lost. And then Living Breathing is the thing that happened, the thing that's different to you, the ability to live, the ability to breathe. Kiss Me Before I Forget, that's just an in-joke I had with my partner, actually. But I like to you know, to think of it as like if you're thinking of like the kiss of life, you know, CPR, the bringing of something to animation through a kiss. And then Song of the Motherland is when you realize the thing that did the possessing, the thing that's given you the spirit, is the Song of the Motherland. You know, the actual, yeah, the song of that imagined place that we've come from,
yeah,
is what took up you and gave you the ability to actually raise yourself out of the dislocation that you see at the beginning of the End of Innocence and the Planets and Star Collapse.
Putting your music up online is not always the easiest thing in the world to figure out, but DistroKid makes music distribution fun and easy with unlimited uploads, and as an artist, you keep 100% of your royalties and earnings. 1 million+ artists rely on DistroKid to get their music into Spotify, Apple Music, YouTube, TikTok, Tidal, Instagram, all the major streaming services. You can use it to edit your lyrics and your song credits. So important in the internet age to let people know the kind of people you're collaborating with. And DistroKid makes that easy. You can also see all your stats from the streamers and, of course, add a credit card to purchase album extras. The DistroKid app is available now on iOS and Android. Go to the app or Play Store to download it. So often, musicians will talk about how the spirit that sort of guides their process feels like something outside of them, right? You know, that it's coming from someplace else. And maybe that's just the subconscious or whatever. Maybe there is a more mystical dimension to it. I certainly think that I enjoy entertaining that notion, but it's such a cool thing for you to have created with these titles a kind of structure and a kind of narrative arc, right? You know, and it's a
That's a pretty incredible
thing. Obviously, anybody who's making a flute record these days is going to end up having to get asked about Andre 3000, but he's on the he's on the record with you. So it's funny.
Yeah.
You guys were probably on parallel journeys, right? I mean, like how did when did it cross sort of onto your side of things, like, oh shit, like Andre's working with woodwinds too, you know, something's afoot.
I think the first thing that I saw was when he released that duet with James Blake, like Man or Hands, with him on bass clarinet, 20 minute improv, and I was just like, whoa,
yeah,
that's really great. If it wasn't called Andre 3000, it was just some free improver had released something on bass clarinet with a piano, I think, yeah, it's real cool, you know, free improv stuff. But to then hear that it's Andre 3000, someone that's known for something else completely, it just made me think that's a real courageous, you know, spirit.
Yeah.
You know, to be able to put out there, because it's a vulnerable position to be in, to put your soul out there, to be critiqued, you know. I just think it took a lot of, courage for him to be able to say, this is where I'm at. I am a creative artist, and I'm finding out what that means by just doing it. And then after that, seeing him playing, you know, on little kind of things on the internet, flutes in various places.
Right.
Yeah, and I realized that he's also in this path. So when we actually crossed paths for the recording of his album, yeah, it was really just like, you know, it was just really natural. Like whenever we've played together, just me and him, we just play like two people that have been practicing forever, together for years.
Yeah.
It really is real natural. And I think it's because there's just a similar thing that you get when you're practicing non-Western flute, which is that you sit down by yourself and you just create little melodies, you jam along with them for hours. you know.
Yeah.
I found that one of the things that I remember thinking when I started to really get into the flute was that even though at the beginning I'd play a flute that's got seemingly one key, I could just create melodies and ideas continuously. I could play like with five notes. I could create melodies and play for like hours.
Yeah.
And I might have repeated stuff. I might have come back to ideas, but it didn't seem like I was being repetitive. It just felt like I was going forward in a consistent stream of melody. That as opposed to the saxophone, where I've got all of this seemingly harmonic choice, but it just seems like the system, the harmonic system, can sometimes exhaust you and run you into these, you know, end points.
Yeah.
Where with that limitation seems to be more freeing of the, you know, of less notes on the flute. And I think that actually when you get someone like Andre, who's also coming in contact with these instruments, he's had that same thing, which is that he just plays for hours. He'll just pick up the flute and just play around with it. So then we come together and it's just two guys that spent a lot of time just noodling around on the flute.
Yeah.
And then together. Yeah.
That's super cool. And I think that that's a really interesting point you're making about how you could just take a couple notes on the flute and just be in this melodic zone. It makes me think a lot about the human voice and how much more like a human's voice the flute would be, right? You know what I mean?
Yeah. Also, if you think someone, a flute player from Pakistan actually told me this a while ago, which is that the flute's the only instrument where you take away material and you take it away until you get to the flute.
Right.
You don't add material to it. You get the piece of wood and you take away.
Yeah.
You bore the hole and take away. And then, voila, that's the flute. So you're making the most minimal form resonate. And I guess with the voice, it's that you're not even taking away anything.
Yeah.
You're just making your, you know, wind pipes vibrate.
Yeah. You know. Yeah, no, that's beautiful though to think about the flute as like an instrument created by subtraction, as opposed to, you know, I'm gluing strings to this piece of wood and putting a pickup in it and all that stuff, you know, which don't get me wrong. I like that. Specifically, I think Andre is playing a flute from Teotihuacan, which is like the pyramid in the pyramids in Mexico City. Is that right? Do you know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
I have been there once, and the flute scene there is pretty killer. It's a pretty good location. When I visited, I just remember seeing, you know, the majesty of these giant pyramids, but being really struck by the incredible, you know, just vendors who were selling little trinkets and stuff, but playing flutes. I bought a dog flute and I have not managed to make any pleasant noises on it, but that's a pretty cool place. So I was really excited to see that that's where his had come from. But I also understand that you growing up in Barbados, you'd often practice your clarinet along with hip hop. So I'm curious if Outkast was in the mix back then. Were you an Outkast fan? Yeah,
I'm a massive Outkast fan. Like I really am the biggest Andre 3000 fan. Which is why this whole situation is completely surreal to me.
Yeah.
Because I'm literally listening to some playlist that had Latin music when I was in Barbados growing up. You know? And
right.
I'm a big, I think, you know, after what's the one that got the last one, A Premonite. I kind of didn't follow the next few albums.
Yeah.
In that I've not listened to them as deeply, but up to A Premonite.
Yeah.
Obviously the, you know, the double one they did.
The Speaker Box and the Love Below, the two.
Yeah. I've listened to that a lot. Well, Andre's part of it.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I'm really big into Outkast and Andre's just rhyme flow. You know, I think there's something special about how he uses cadence.
Oh,
that's
it's
crazy. Even on that last Killer Mike, you know, Scientists and Engineers, the verse that Andre does.
Yeah.
There's something that he does in the middle of his rap where he just like flips the cadence around in a way that's just mystical, I think is the best way of putting it.
Yeah.
Because
it just, it, you could describe, you could, you know, transcribe it and work out exactly what he does. But it just is something where it just feels like it's mysterious in its complexity and bears not even unpacking because of how good it feels. And for me, that's the basis of mysticism also.
Yeah.
You could probably get an explanation if you try to analyze it, but the joy is actually in just how it makes you feel.
Yeah.
And the impact that it gives to you.
Yeah. The joy is in the mystery to some degree, right? I mean,
yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's really nicely put. And he does have that ability to sort of execute what would be like a very complex, you know, technical thing, but in this sort of way that doesn't feel like that's what it is. It just feels like it's like like an organic, almost biological sort of process at work, which is really which is really cool. So I was just so excited to see him on this. And, you know, obviously you have so many incredible collaborators on this one. Saul Williams, I think of Esperanza Spalding's playing on Body and Body to Inhabit. Her bass part on that almost reminds me of like The Creator Has a Master Plan or A Love Supreme, the sort of like mantra like, you know, line or whatever. So, you know, you've got these incredible folks on this record, but it also feels so, it feels so of a piece. Like everybody fits in a way that it doesn't feel like, okay, and now here comes this feature, you know, it's going to bring this whole different thing. It doesn't feel that way at all. So, I mean, it's really pretty incredible in that regard.
Yeah. I just feel like I'm incredibly lucky. It felt like stars were aligning in so many, you know, in so many ways.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Even like Moses Sumney, the fact that, and you know, I kind of got him on the record. Like I remember seeing Moses for the first time many, many years ago when he was playing at South by Southwest, and being blown away by him. And then meeting him slightly after at this festival in France called Transmusicale, that prize itself for bringing people that aren't really known to France, this festival, hanging out with him there. And then we just kept in contact over the years, and I played on a couple of his albums, on Grey and an EP that he released. And then I just messaged him, like, you know, do you want to play on this track? And he said, yeah. And then it just took many months of just chasing up. And then when he finally delivered his contribution, I was just like, wow, I can't believe it's actually, you know, coming together.
Yeah. You know, it's so interesting because I feel like right now there is such such expansive thinking that is taking place in this genre of music that I guess, for the lack of a better term, you know, we'll say jazz, you know, sort of knowing that we're talking about jazz that also draws from electronic music and ambient music, neoclassical, you know, rap. I feel like new age, you know, if we want to throw Laraji into the mix, you know, and to me, that is just so, it's so cool because on one hand, you know, there's always this like hand wringing about like jazz is going away or jazz is like classical music and that it's a specialty, you know, sort of thing. But I just feel like over the last couple of years, we've just seen this explosion of stuff.
I mean, for me, I can only talk from the perspective of someone who isn't directly within the culture and tradition, which means that I've had to just listen to what the key roles of the music have actually said. That's all I can go on. All I can go on is what Charlie Parker, Miles Davis, and Sonny Rollins and Ray sort of said about
right
the word jazz and what it's supposed to mean. And it just seems like summarily, all they say, everyone, is that jazz is not a particular kind of music. It's an approach to creativity. And any attempt to kind of to truncate it and to put it into a box is anti what they would like the music to be.
Right.
And all my heroes have said in different words, you know, Duke Ellington said it, Louis Armstrong said it, Charles Mingus said it. They said they don't like the word jazz because it's something that seems like it's limiting the scope of their creative capacity.
Right.
And it's used in that way. But then somehow it is morphed into this idea that jazz is a particular kind of music. But jazz is a spirit or an approach to creation.
Right.
So obviously, if it's a creative principle, then you're going to get different manifestations of that principle. And that's the art of it, I guess.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And it's complex because, you know, you have, you know, specific music. Like, you know, if you're going to look at the music of Charlie Parker or the music of, you know, Chick Corea or you know, and like what the music itself is, what bebop is, then that's a music form and it's got its own language. But then it's like, it's complex because jazz, the thing that ended up with the form known as bebop, is a creative principle applied to a particular period of time, which doesn't mean that the result of that principle is the principle, you know?
Yeah.
It's like the word culture, you know, someone saying what the culture, like the shakuhachi is Japanese culture. And I would beg to differ. I would say that Japanese culture is the thing that's reflected by, or an aspect of Japanese culture is the thing reflected by the music. The music isn't the culture. The music is the reflection of the culture.
Sure.
The culture is something deeper that has to have a form, and that form can attach itself to music or dance or any other aspect. But if you're then looking at the abstract thing, what the culture is, what the sensitivity of a society is, that needs to be reflected in the creative arts, then it becomes a lot more, yeah, just a lot more abstract and a lot more conceptual. And I think that's a similar thing with the word jazz. It's deep and conceptual.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. And I mean, I think that that is like, I mean, I think that... here we are talking in 2024, right? And like, you can go back and listen to Miles Davis. I was listening to Agartha earlier today, and you know, it's just as like far out and funky and crazy and wild as anything coming out right now, you know?
Yeah.
And as forward looking and as future music sounding, you know? So I do think that like, what I think what's interesting is that jazz right now, people are, I think, being drawn to that expression precisely because of its openness and its ability to transmute and morph and incorporate influences from all over the place, right? I mean, it's no shock that so much of this current sort of jazz bloom or, you know, renaissance or whatever was fueled by people who had been playing in, you know, rap groups or whatever, right? For years.
Yeah.
Kamasi making a living, you know, backing up Snoop or whatever. But meanwhile, there's this deep history and tradition, and the West Coast always had that. And then you've got what you guys were doing over in London, and it's just like a completely different reflection that is also just as exciting. And it, as it starts to just, these feedback loops start getting created, there's different cross-pollination. All of a sudden, Andre 3000's on your record, you're hanging out with Carlos Nino. You know, it's like, it's a really cool thing that's happening right now. I think it speaks, I think it speaks to people's hunger for music of substance, of spiritual substance, even if that's not going too far.
No, I really think so. And I think it actually, it bears the question of what does it mean to have music a spiritual substance? And even what does it mean to be spiritual? And even what is spirit?
Yeah.
A lot of the times these words are used and no one ever stops to define them apart from a weird reductive dictionary definition.
Yeah.
And for me, spirit is simple. Spirit is an energizing force.
Yeah.
You know, it's something... Like, if you look at the opposite of spirit, for me, is inertia.
Sure.
You know, if you're lying on your back and you don't know how to go forward, you don't know what, you know, spirit is the thing that makes you get up and like, say, I am going to. Like, for instance, if you've not been going to the gym or going out to your house or going on a walk, and you're in a bit of a rut, you're in a depressive zone, and you listen to a piece of music that just puts a smile on your face, makes you just relax, and you just, after you listen to that music, you go, actually, you know what, I can do this. I'm gonna get up, and just walk around the block as a start, then you've been injected with something that gave you vitality that made you say, I am going to move forward. And for me, that vitality, spirit is the personification of that like force that allowed you to press forward. And when you get, you know, it's like when you start actually getting deeper with it and starting to differentiate the different orientations of the forces and where you can go in different realms, that's when you start getting very complex into like how other cultures or how not a lot of non-Western cultures define spirituality. But for me, essentially, it's just an animating force. It's a force, a vital force. So if you're looking at spiritual music, you're looking at music that actually affects your vitality and affects you on a level that's not necessarily analytical, that just makes you feel, you know, like you've got an energy that makes you, you know, puts a smile on your face or gives you some kind of, energy.
I really like the way that you put that.
Yeah,
you know, and this is obviously stuff that you have spent a lot of time thinking about, and I'm curious how it relates to, you know, your upbringing. You talked about being back in Barbados, practicing the flute in the place where you grew up. And the final song on the album, Song of the Motherland, I wasn't 100% sure. Is that a new recording of the piece that your father put out on his album, 1985, from 1985, Song of the Motherland, or?
Yeah, that's a new recording of it.
Okay, well, that's really incredible. First off, I hadn't heard his album. And so I was able, you know, getting ready for this interview, realize, oh, wow, he did album art for people like King Tubby and the Heptones and all sorts of people. So it's like, I was like, oh, wow, his dad did, you know, art for these like legendary reggae records. And then I was like, wait, and he put out this record, you know, song.
And he's got two poetry books also.
Oh, you ready for it? That's incredible. How did that all come together? And was that a, you know, did you grow up hearing him perform that? How did that idea kind of all come together?
The idea came together might be going, this is a real travesty that no one knows how badass he is.
Yeah.
You know, it's crazy. And I think it's just due to there not be a solid, like a codified record archive of what he's done.
Yeah.
It's all very like stretched out. He wanted to come to the studio actually to just do something else to record. You know, he does a lot of ceremonial work. So he wanted to just record some like ceremonial drumming like he could use in some of these ceremonies. And I knew he was coming, so I brought one of his poetry books. I kind of finished the, you know, at least the basis of the track that I'd like him to know. And when he came, I played it to him and was like, I'd really love you to read this poem. I've got the book. Here's the track. He listened to like a minute to the track and he's like, okay, you know, I've not really performed poetry, you know, live in about 15 years, but, you know, I'll do something. And he just did one take. And as you can hear on the record, the poet, even without him having heard the entire tune, but the poem finishes on the last beat of music completely organically.
Wow.
One take of you having him even hear it heard.
Wow.
You know, the whole tune.
Wow. Yeah. When we had John Lurie on this podcast, he said, he had a quote from his book. He said, coincidences are God's way of saying hello. You must have felt like that was more than coincidental that the poem concluded precisely when it needed to.
No, I was really shocked and a little bit perturbed.
Yeah.
I'm actually reissuing his album Song of the Motherland on my label on Native Rebel Recordings. Should be out at the end of May.
That's so cool. I mean, and it's such an incredible thing for you to be able to share your artistic project with him. And then also, you know, I just found myself thinking about the beautiful alignment of the fact that it's, you know, Song of the Motherland, you know, and so obviously we're thinking about this concept of a motherland. We're thinking of this concept of a of a sort of feminine source, right? And then it's your dad, so it's got this like familial connection. I don't know. I just thought it was really quite beautiful. And then, you know, listening back to the original recording, I realized, okay, this, he's definitely not being sampled here. You know, this is like a new take on it.
Yeah.
But to hear the years in his voice, even, right? You know.
Yeah, exactly.
That's moving too. So I mean, it was really all of the vocals on this are particularly moving. But that one, his parts really, really hit me. And I thought it was just a beautiful way for you to end the record like that.
Yeah, Leanne Harris's contribution actually was really, that's my favorite vocal contribution in that it was a really, you know, we were in the studio, we were trying to figure out actually, how does she contribute to this type of music?
Yeah.
We didn't want to sing a song.
Right.
We didn't want her to like, just do, you know, cliched R&B or like, you know, vocalized kind of bits. So what I kind of told her was, you know, like, I don't know if you know the movie Dancer in the Dark.
Oh, the Bjork film.
Bjork.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because that last scene where Bjork's on like death row and she starts singing My Favorite Things to herself. And for me, that's one of the most powerful, you know, musical moments.
Yeah.
You know, on. It's really like heart-wrenching because he's like, she's singing it to herself. It's just something that feels deeply intimate and personal. And it's like, I was telling Leanne, that's the spirit that I want to come out. Like, you're humming something to yourself that's got this meaning, but your mouth is shut. It's not something that you're singing out to the world. It's something that you actually, it's like you're deep in reflection, trying to get out this thing that's deep, like intensely personal and intimate.
Yeah.
Just hum it.
Wow. That's beautiful. That's beautiful. And, you know, seriously, it's been so fun talking about this record, digging into it. Before I let you go, I have to ask, we talked about how, you know, we mentioned Floating Points and Pharoah Saunders, his final album, we had Floating Points on right before you guys did that show where you guys staged that performance. And I know that you were hand selected by Pharoah Saunders to play his sax parts. I wanted to ask you in closing, what your experiences with Pharoah Saunders were like and how they, you know, shaped or informed your own approach to music.
I mean, he's just a cool guy, you know. Like, every time I met him, he's just real nice. You know, I think I met him for the first time in New York, where I was playing opposite him in the Ensemble Roots Winter Jazz Fest. And I remember I turned up before the band, and he was in the dressing room. We just had a big chat, not even about music, just about general the stuff. You know, it's really cool. And then, you know, there was another festival in France that, you know, I was backstage, and You know, he's like, oh, come, you know, I'm in the warm-up. So I was just there, like, you know, hanging around him as in his dressing room as he was warming up on the sax and thinking, oh, this is so far out. And then it just seemed like I kept on bumping into him on the roads, in hotel lobbies, in backstage and festivals. And then he heard me play a few times. I played a set with the Alice Coltrane Ashram, the singer from the Ashram.
Yeah.
And he was there stage, and remember, you know, he checked quite a bit after that, and it just made a great supportive guy. And you know, he gave his number and just said, you know, give me a call, and you know, whenever you're in town, just, you know, come and see me. So yeah, it just made me really appreciative that this older legendary musician would take the time to actually, human, you know, a young upstart like me.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, whether or not he said it, obviously you're helping to continue on the tradition that he was a part of. And this record is just, like I said, so great. Yeah. Definitely one of my favorite things of the year so far. And Chewbacca, it's been a real blast hanging out and talking about it. Thank you for your time. I sure do appreciate
thanks
it.
Thanks for that. Legend. Thanks.
Thanks for listening. I'm Jason P. Woodbury. I produce, write, and host this show. Transmissions is edited by Andrew Horton. Art for this episode was assembled by Ian Everett, and the photo of Chewbacca is by Abita Photo. Our executive producer is Justin Gage, Aquarium Drunkard's founder. Don't miss his weekly radio program, The Aquarium Drunkard Show, on SiriusXMU, Channel 35, at 7 p.m. Pacific Time, each and every Wednesday night. You can subscribe to our website and online music magazine, Aquarium Drunkard, over at Aquarium Drunkard. We appreciate your support. Transmissions is part of the Talkhouse Podcast Network. Visit the Talkhouse for more interviews, fascinating reads, and podcasts. I'll be back next week, and we will be joined by Jim Jupp, founder of Ghostbox Records and Bellbury Polly, and truthfully, the very first interview that I recorded for this current season. So I'm really excited to share that one with you. I hope you will come back. In the meantime, be well. This transmission is concluded.